Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Chuck Collins, who's a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he directs the program on inequality and the common good. He's the co-author of several books, including Economic Apartheid in America, A Primer on Economic Inequality and Insecurity, The Moral Measure of the Economy, and Wealth and Our Commonwealth, which he co-wrote with Bill Gates Sr. He's the co-founder of Wealth for the Common Good, a network of business leaders, high-income households, and partners working together to promote shared prosperity and tax fairness. His latest book, just out, is 99 to 1, How Wealth Inequality is Wrecking the World and What We Can Do About It. Welcome to Background Briefing, Chuck Collins.
Thank you, Ian. Thanks for having me.
And on Sunday, the New York Times cover, the magazine, has a cover story, Are the Rich Worth a Damn? Let's Ask a Guy from Bain Capital, an extraordinary article. And, of course, it's preceding a book that's going to be published by Mitt Romney's former partner at Bain Capital, Edward Cunard, who is, by the way, Mitt Romney's biggest donor. And he's not just a 1%er, but a 0.01%. And he's arguing here that wealth inequality is not a sign that our economy is in trouble. It's a sign that our economy is working and that a little more inequality would be good for the 99%. I guess that's an updated version of Marie Antoinette's Let Them Eat Cake.
Yeah, it's it's an extraordinary argument, but it's not unusual. You know, you hear people in the 1% who kind of developed a worldview based on their own kind of personal theories and experience themselves. I mean, you know, here's a guy who's essentially lived in a bubble pretty much his whole life, who's saying, wow, inequality is an incentive for greatness. Unfortunately, it's not an economic system. It's really a political system. We're now living in a period of extreme wealth inequality that doesn't have anything to do with incentives or, you know, the deservedness of a few hardworking people or any of those kind of myths or canards, if you will. They are, you know, it's a distortion. It's a politically rigged game where a segment of the 1% has rigged the rules in their favor. That's why we're in this mess, not because of some virtuous economic activity.
But it's not us that are in this mess. It's the entire mythology of America, it would seem, Chuck Collins. It's always been the American dream has always been reposed in the middle class. It's always been an assumption that America is a middle class country and that that's its strength and its anchor, if you will. And clearly, it's not. I mean, you could question whether we are still a democracy, whether we've become an oligarchy running a plutonomy. But when do you think we're going to start talking about myth versus reality in terms of our central myth about the American dream?
Well, I think that myth is cracking. And, you know, whether it's people who were aspiring to the middle class dream and seeing that the rules are now rigged against them, or to even, you know, people I've organized in the 1% through like the Wealth for the Common Good Network. These are folks who are wealthy, but are looking out and saying, well, look, my wealth is a function, you know, some of it's my own effort, but it's largely a function of the society and the public investments and the sort of fertile ground that we all create together. And so they're kind of busting the myth even from within the 1%. And, you know, yes, you're going to see arguments like Edward Cunard's, which are newsworthy because they're rather extreme. But I think 70% of the population has gotten over, to some extent, the deep mythology that the super billionaires are there by virtue of their virtues. Not, you know, a lot of people understand now that the game was rigged. The 2008 economic meltdown was part of that. That these folks have seen their wealth greatly increase since then because of their ability to corner markets and rig the rules in their favor. So I think the myth is falling on hard times.
Well, I would think, though, that the real issue, surely, Chuck Collins, is the extent to which the wealthy and the super wealthy have bought out politics. The reason that the game is rigged now against the middle class and working Americans is that the rich own our government. If they don't own, they seem to own the Republican Party outright, and they rent the Democratic Party.
Yeah, we are living at a time of capture. The 1% and a couple thousand global companies have captured our democratic system. And yet, you know, so that's why you have a situation where, you know, 240 members of the House of Representatives and 40-plus members of the U.S. Senate have taken Grover Norquist's tax pledge never to vote for a tax increase under any circumstances, war, famine, you know, whatever. So the current political situation is in a complete impasse because the politics reflects, you know, yesterday's understanding. But the public opinion is shifting radically in another direction. People want millionaires to pay their fair share of taxes. They want to close down the offshore tax system that lets some companies gain their taxes and avoid accountability. You know, the public opinion is moving more and more, I guess, in a progressive direction. They're not falling for the myths. But in the short term, the politics is going to be stuck, you know, so you're going to see Democrats in the Senate saying, let's pass the Buffett rule and have millionaires pay their fair share of taxes, and then it doesn't even, you know, pass the votes required to eliminate a filibuster. That's the short term, but the long term is this is going to lead to a realignment.
Again, I'm speaking with Chuck Collins, a co-founder with Bill Gates of Wealth for the Common Good. He has a new book just out, 99% to 1, How Wealth Inequality is Wrecking the World and What We Can Do About It. You mentioned Grover Norquist. Now, just changing the subject slightly, Chuck Collins, Grover Norquist, of course, is powerful not because of his own personality, but rather because he's being funded by very, very wealthy interests who he does not reveal who they are. He is apparently going to be successful in knocking off Senator Lugar in Indiana on Tuesday, and he's running a Tea Party candidate who he's funding. And the amazing thing about this race is that the Tea Party candidate, his platform, the ads that Grover Norquist's Club for Growth are paying for, argue that, okay, so Lugar is a statesman, but he's not conservative enough. I mean, I'm astounded that here in the United States, we have reached a point where we're denigrating a statesman and suggesting that conservatism is a greater virtue than statesmanship.
No, it's really a tragedy that someone as open-minded as Richard Lugar is going to lose their seat. But that is the Grover Norquist strategy. That is how they flex their muscles and hold everyone in line. They have, you know, done a good job organizing to get candidates for Congress to take their pledge. But ultimately, their power lies in raising tens of millions of dollars from conservatives to eliminate, to have people lose their seats. On the other hand, and the same strategy, though, is important because, you know, there are going to be a lot of other candidates this fall that will lose their seats because they have been, you know, lapdogs for the 1%. You know, they are going to, you know, they're going to be people who are going to run against sitting incumbents who continue to vote to eliminate the inheritance tax, who vote for tax cuts for the rich, but vote against, you know, loan programs for college students. Those folks are going to be called out in the same way. So I think we're going to see these issues of inequality of wealth at the center of the political debate this summer and fall.
But Chuck Collins, do you think or do you see any way that the political left in this country can even begin to organize like the right does? I mean, you have not just the Grover Norquists being funded by plutocrats, but you also have this group ALEC who have organized. In fact, the Republicans' greatest success, and to some extent it's under the radar, has been to capture all these state legislatures and to completely re-engineer politics at the state level into a very conservative direction. They literally are putting ex-lobbyists in as representatives and then giving them the ALEC agenda, and they're passing laws all around the country to turn the clock back. And it doesn't feel like there's anything on the left that's just that well organized. You have the isolated examples of the Warren Buffetts, who, of course, was just challenged at the Berkshire Hathaway shareholders meeting by some of the dissidents there on the right. Buffett told them that if they weren't happy with Berkshire Hathaway stock, then maybe they should buy Fox News stock, which I thought was a brilliant dig, since everybody clearly in this country wants to own Berkshire Hathaway. And you've worked with Bill Gates Sr., and he famously made the statement, you can't sail two yachts at the same time. And George Soros gives some money, but not to politics. He gives them mostly to economic studies and more academic stuff. So I don't see... I see isolated examples of wealthy people in this country with a conscience, but I don't see an organized structure.
Well, we can't sort of wait for the billionaires to do the job. I mean, the good news is there are you know, at the federal level, there's a Congressional Progressive Caucus, and in many states there are parallel caucuses of progressive state legislators. They don't have the same infrastructure and clout and kind of communications capacity that the right has built over really over four decades. But they're, you know, so the right, you know, the 1% and the corporate elites have huge capacity, particularly in communications, but they don't hold all the cards. And I think that's the thing to look for, is where is there's some cracks in the system. I mean, we now have public opinion on our side. We have a growing, you know, infrastructure of groups like Rebuild the Dream and the U.S. Action Network and a number of great, strong community-based organizations that are engaging at all levels in policy. So I think we're going to be contenders, you know, in terms of this pushback. And I think it's going to be an interesting spring and summer and fall. I think there's going to be this kind of awakening. I just was part of a demonstration with the National Nurses Union in favor of a Wall Street transaction tax. Here's an idea that was completely considered off the table a year ago, and which is moving rapidly to becoming a real debated policy proposal. Let's pass a small transaction tax on financial transactions, would generate a substantial amount of money. So even ideas that were considered too far out of left field are now moving into the center. So, we're up against a very powerful infrastructure, and now we have Citizens United, and tens of millions of dollars will flow into TV attack advertising this fall that may or may not have an influence on the outcomes. But we got to work with what we have, I guess.
Again, I'm speaking with Chuck Collins, who is the co-founder of Wealth for the Common Good, and his latest book just out is 99 to 1, How Wealth Inequality is Wrecking the World and What We Can Do About It. The in terms of what we can do about it, in terms of a cultural shift, and, you know, I'm speaking to you from Hollywood, where there's considerable influence, I think, in the way that... movies and popular culture are a powerful force. That's one of the reasons why the conservatives in this country get so upset with Hollywood. But at the end of the day, you know, who are people going to listen to? George Clooney or Chuck Norris? But that's not to say that there are some sort of malignant strains in our popular culture. We have people like Paris Hilton and Kim Kardashian who have literally contribute nothing and make tons of money out of being exemplars of the idol rich. Do you think that there's going to be a cultural shift here in this, the extent to which the 99% movement have captured a lot of attention?
Well, you know, I sit here in Boston, and but I was recently in Los Angeles and get a chance to travel. What I've noticed is there is a very vibrant local kind of 99% culture, both music and other performance and visual artists, poets, storytellers. You know, it may be that the big networks and the sort of stratosphere of communications and culture are controlled or remote, but boy, there is a vibrant local culture emerging. You know, here in the Northeast, in the last couple of years, there's emergence of what we call honk bands, these community street activist marching bands that are popping up all over. We had a huge parade here yesterday in my neighborhood. We had six local honk bands. These are people who are, you know, maybe they're frustrated high school marching band folks that come together, and they liven up every protest, every event, every bank occupation, every street march now has a sort of vibrant culture, and it draws people in, and it's fun, and it gives energy to all these organizing efforts. So I see the same thing reflected in sort of the storytelling, the poet and the visual artist. It's just, there's really a flowering of a culture from below, a bottom-up culture, and that's the way it's going to come. We may not see it on the nightly news.
Well, just in closing, in the last minute, Chuck Collins, your subtitle to your book, 99-1, is How Wealth Inequality is Wrecking the World and What We Can Do About It. The French elections indicate that things may be changing in the world, where there's a move away from these austerity policies that are wrecking Europe and have stalled growth in this country. Do you take any heart at the fact that John Maynard Keynes is being rediscovered, slowly, albeit?
I do, and interestingly enough, Sarkozy's last-ditch effort to try to win public opinion in France was to institute a financial transaction tax, a financial speculation tax. He became a champion of that, but he still lost his seat. But because he's not moving to the left enough, and he's not sort of parroting the austerity message, so I think that's a good sign. Although, actually, I think John Maynard Keynes will help us a little bit, but actually we need sort of almost a whole new economic theory that helps us think through what is the transition to a new economy that is ecological look like. It's not going to be the old prime-the-pump state borrowing and creating high-wage jobs.
Right, the shovel-ready stuff, yeah. It has to be more imaginative.
I mean, that's going to help us in the transition, but we need to move toward a whole new paradigm, really.
Well, you've given us
another conversation, right?
You've given us something to think about, and I would like to have another conversation. So I'll be in touch if you don't mind.
No, of course. I always enjoy talking to you, Ian. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thanks a lot. Again, I've been speaking with Chuck Collins, who's a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he directs the program on inequality and common good. He's the co-author of several books, including Economic Apartheid in America, A Primer on Economic Equality and Insecurity, and The Moral Measure of the Economy and Wealth and Our Commonwealth, which he co-wrote with Bill Gates Sr. He's the co-founder of Wealth for the Common Good, and his latest book just out is 99-1, How Wealth Inequality is Wrecking the World and What We Can Do About It. Again, this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. A quiet voice singing something to me. An angel song about the home of the brave and this land here of the free. One time, one night in America. A lady dressed in white with a man she loved. The headline reads